Finally now, move away from East Putney Station and turn right under the other railway bridge, walking past Summerfield, and at the lights there cross back to the other side of the Upper Richmond Road. Straight ahead is Wandsworth County Court, a brutal rectangular building, bearing over its centre doors a coat of arms of a unicorn and lion, their paws and hooves resting on a heraldic shield. The identity of the inexplicable man who lives in Werter Road will be decided by the judgment in the case of Witt versus Parfitts. If Witt wins his action, then Parfitts might retire from business. Mr. Oxford will probably go to prison for having sold goods on false pretences, and the name of Henry Leake, valet, will be added to the list of adventurous scoundrels who have pretended to be their masters. But if Witt should lose, the national funeral of Priam Farl has been a fraudulent farce. A common valet lays under the hallowed stones of the abbey. Europe has mourned in vain, and a gigantic and unprecedented swindle has been practised upon the nation. Mr. Pennington, K.C., in representing the case for the prosecution, begins.
Whitney C. Witt is claiming £72,000 from the defendants, money paid for worthless pictures palmed off upon my myopic and venerable plaintiff as masterpieces, in an attempt to take advantage of a blind man. Can I ask you, who can blame the plaintiff for his confidence in the uprightness of a firm with such a name as Parfitts? It was down to an accident of a dating stamp on a canvas that allowed my client to discover that the pictures, guaranteed to be by Priam Farl, were painted after Priam Farl's death. But as you will hear presently from the defendant, Priam Farl has not really been dead. It was his valet who died. And quite naturally, quite comprehensibly, the great genius Priam Farl wished to pass the remainder of his career as a humble valet, deceiving everybody. And as Henry Leake he married, and as Henry Leake he recommenced the art of painting in Putney, of which vocation he carried on for several years, without arousing the suspicions of a single person, until by a curious coincidence, immediately after my client threatened an action against the defendant, he displayed himself in his true identity as Priam Farl. Such is the simple explanation, which, as experienced persons of the world, doubtless you will perceive that such things are of constant daily occurrence. I'm almost ashamed to stand up before you and endeavour to rebut a story so plausible and so essentially convincing. I feel that my task is well nigh hopeless. Nevertheless, I must do my best.
Mr. Vaudrey, K.C. for the defendant, then calls his first witness, Mrs. Leake, to the stand.
Madam, is that your husband?
It is.
But am I right in recounting that when you first met Mr. Leake at his home in Putney, you were not sure?
It's all come over me since. Shouldn't a woman recognise the father of her own children?
Well, she should.
Then Pennington calls Duncan Farl to the stand.
Therefore, I think I have thus shown in 50 ways that this man could not have been Priam. The man now who masquerades as Priam is not even a gentleman, whereas Priam is my cousin, after all.
One you have not seen since boyhood.
Your Honour, if Mr. Vaudrey wishes to identify the past as a point of issue, then I have no desire to turn my witness from the point. Tell us about your boyhood, spent with your cousin, Mr. Farl.
Well, we fought.
Oh, you fought. What did you two naughty boys fight about?
A plum cake, I think.
And what was the outcome of this sanguine affair?
My cousin loosened one of my teeth.
And what did you do to him?
I'm afraid I didn't do much. I remember tearing off his clothes.
Oh, I'm sure you remember that. You're sure that it wasn't he who tore your clothes off?
No, it was I. I remember now that my cousin had two little moles on his neck below the collar. I seem to remember seeing them. I've just thought of it.
Thank you. You can step down.
After this, the pictures themselves are brought in. Then after this, the experts, followed by technical evidence. Until a clerk is heard calling,
Leak to the box.
Now, Priam's attitude towards the whole case is one of bitter resentment. He hates Wit as keenly as he hates Oxford. All that he demands from the world is peace and quietness. But all that he has got is forced interment in Westminster Abbey. If he chooses to call himself by another name, why should he not do so? If he chooses to marry a simple woman and live in a suburb and paint pictures at £10 each, why should he not do so? Why should he be dragged out of his tranquillity because two persons in whom he feels no interest whatever have quarrelled over his pictures? Why should his life be made unbearable in Putney by the extravagant curiosity of a mob of journalists? And then, why should he be compelled now, by means of a piece of blue paper, to go through this crowning, frightful ordeal in a witness box?
Now, you say you went with the defendant to his club and that he told you of the difficulty he was in?
Yes.
Did he make you any offer of money?
Yes.
Ah. What did he offer you?
£36,000.
So? And what was this £36,000 to be for?
I don't know.
You don't know? Come now. But you accepted the offer.
No. I refused it.
Why did you refuse it?
Because I didn't care to accept it.
Then no money passed between you that day?
Yes. £500.
What for?
A picture.
The same kind of picture that you'd been selling at £10?
Yes.
So that on the very day that the defendant wanted you to swear that you were Priam Fowle, the price of your pictures rose from £10 to £500?
Yes.
Doesn't that strike you as odd?
Yes.
You still say, mind, Leake, you are on your oath. You still say that you refused £36,000 in order to accept £500.
I sold a picture for £500.
Right, let's move on. Now, how about the encounter with Mr. Duncan Fowle? Of course, if you really are Priam Fowle, you remember all about that.
Yes.
What age were you?
I don't know. About 9.
Oh, a suitable age for plum cake. Now, Mr. Duncan Fowle says you loosened one of his teeth.
I did.
And that he tore your clothes?
I dare say.
He says he remembers the fact because you had 2 moles.
Yes.
Have you 2 moles?
Yes.
Where are they?
On my neck, just below my collar.
Perhaps, if I'm not asking too much, you will take your collar off and show the 2 moles to the court?
No.
You would prefer to do it, perhaps, in his lordship's room, if his lordship consents.
I won't do it anywhere. I will not do it anywhere, my lord.
The witness has 2 moles on his neck, exactly as described by Mr. Duncan Fowle, but he will not display them.
While 11 legal minds bend nobly to the problem of whether the law and justice of England can compel a man to take his collar off if he refuses to take his collar off, in the meantime the case has to proceed. Alice is called to the witness box.
And now, Mrs. Leake.
Shouldn't you be calling me Mrs. Fowle?
Madam, I'm the one to be posing the questions, if you please. So, about these moles. You pointed to the right side of your neck. Are you sure they aren't on the left side?
Let me think now. When he's shaving of a morning, I can see his face in the looking-glass. And in the looking-glass, the moles are on the left side. So on him they must be on the right side, yes. The right side, that's it.
And have you never seen them except in a mirror, my good woman?
I suppose you think that's very funny.
Have you any idea why your husband refuses to submit his neck to the inspection of the court?
Well, if you hadn't turned me out of the court while he was being examined, perhaps I could have told you. But I can't as it is, so it serves you right.
I have no further questions, my lord.
Nothing shifts Priam's position. And then, at one point during the trial, he is passing through the King's Bench corridor in the law courts and catches sight of Mr. Oxford talking to a woman. She is tall, thin, and hides her age behind a veil, similar to the one she wore at his funeral when he last spied her.
How do you do, Mr. Fall?
How do you do? Lady Entwistle?
How do you do, Mr. Fall?
How do you do, Mr. Oxford?
I suppose you know, Mr. Fall, that I have to give evidence in this case.
No, I didn't.
Yes. It seems they've scoured all over the continent in vain to find people who knew you under your proper name and who could identify you with certainty. And they couldn't find one. Doubtless owing to your peculiar habits of travel. I was in India when I first heard of this case. And
as Lady Sophia happens to be in London now, she is good enough to give her invaluable evidence on my behalf.
That is scarcely the way to describe it. I'm only here because you compel me to be here by subpoena. If you did not have an acquaintance with my aunt, and she hadn't told you about...
Quite so. It naturally can't be very agreeable to you to have to go into the witness box and submit a cross-examination about your former engagement to Mr. Fall, and I am the more obliged to you for your kindness, Lady Sophia.
What chicanery!
Well, you see, the important point about Lady Sophia's evidence is that in Paris... she saw both you and your valet. The valet, obviously a servant, and you, obviously his master. There can, therefore, be no question of her having been deceived by the valet posing as the master. It is a most fortunate thing that she can be here now.
Mr. Fall, can I speak to you a moment?
I will step outside until you need me, Lady Sophia.
Now, Priam, shall I have to give evidence or not? You know it depends on you.
Oh, please, please don't worry. I will attend to things. I will not have you questioned about, well, our former situation in the witness box.
Thank you, Priam.
And with that, he turns on his heel with a new resolve that threats and even Alice's cajolings could not bring about. To protect Lady Entwistle, he removes his collar for the court, and the case turns irrevocably against Whitney Witt. The press, however, want to trap Prime in the net of the law, but the truth is he has done nothing unlawful. To mollify them after the trial, Prime orders that the Fall Museum be carried to completion and formally conveyed to the nation, and despite all, the nation decides to accept that honourable amend. A few days before boarding their Lloyd's steamer in Southampton, Priam and Alice visit the tomb of Henry Leake in Westminster Abbey. They find an inscription carved into the ground bearing the name of Priam Fall and the dates that he lived.
I'm glad I'm not buried down there.
So am I.
I wonder what they will do with me next time.
It'll be a long time before you or I are buried here or anywhere. And until then, you have nothing to do but paint the most beautiful pictures. Prime, my dear.
Then, as their steamer makes a pathway straight through the tumbling white waters from receding England towards distant Algiers, Priam leans upon the rail, meditating the prospect of years, devoted to the sole doing of that which he can so supremely do, in a sweet exile with the Enchantress, Alice. Perfect. Now, just need to write it. And what shall I call it? What do you think? Yes, that's it. Buried Alive.
A dramatic walk through Putney was written by Maria O'Shoddy, based on Arnold Bennett's novel Buried Alive. Priam Fall was played by Clive Merrison. Arnold Bennett and the clergyman, Tom Marshall. Alice and Sophia, Tamara Hinchco. Pennington, the Doctor, and a policeman, Ronald Markham. Oxford and Vaudrey, Tim Gebbles. Mrs. Leake and the waitress, Heather Gilmore. Duncan Fall, John Leake, and second policeman, Alex McConnell. Production and sound design, Peter Bosher. The director was Maria O'Shoddy.
Thank you.